pull up a chair for this one. Because today, April 29th, is the anniversary of the largest helicopter evacuation in history. And if you fly rotorcraft, or if you've ever wondered what happens when an entire nation's exit strategy comes down to the pilots, this is the day that answers your question. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. 1975. The war in Vietnam is collapsing faster than anyone in Washington wants to admit. North Vietnamese forces have been rolling south for weeks, taking city after city by mid-April. Everyone who's paying attention knows Saigon is going to fall. The only question is when, and the only question that matters to the aviators is how many people they can get out before it does. The plan was called Operation Frequent Wind, and it was the final option, the absolute last resort. The Americans had been running fixed-wing evacuations for weeks, C-141 Starlifters and C-130 Hercules hauling thousands of people out of Tan Son NHD Air Base day after day. But on the morning of April 29th, North Vietnamese rockets slammed into that airfield, cratered the runways, killed two Marines on the perimeter, and just like that, the runways were done, no more fixed wing, no more buses to the airport. The only way out of Saigon was straight up. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo private pilot instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now here's where it gets interesting. Ambassador Graham Martin had been resisting a full evacuation for days. He believed, or wanted to believe, that some kind of negotiated settlement could save Saigon. So the order to launch Frequent Wind didn't come until almost 11 in the morning, Saigon time. And the signal, the one that told everyone in the city that the Americans were leaving for good, was a weather report on Armed Forces radio. The announcer read the words, "The temperature in Saigon is 105 degrees and rising." And then they played Bing Crosby singing White Christmas. That was the code. When you heard that song on the radio in April in the tropics, you knew it was over. The helicopters launched from carriers and amphibious assault ships sitting in the South China Sea. The USS Hancock, the USS Midway, the USS Okinawa. Marine CH-53 Sea Stallions and CH-46 Sea Knights, the big heavy lifters, started making runs into Saigon, landing at the Defense Attaché office compound at Tan Son Anat and at the U.S. Embassy downtown. And the Air America Hueys, the Central Intelligence Agency's civilian airline, those pilots were already in the air before the official order came. They'd been quietly moving people for hours. Picture what those pilots were flying into. Saigon is a city of almost 4 million people, and it's coming apart. The streets are jammed. There's gunfire in the distance. Smoke columns are rising from half a dozen fires. And you're descending in a helicopter into a landing zone the size of a parking lot, surrounded by buildings, with thousands of desperate people pressing against the gates trying to get inside the compound. The noise alone, rotor wash, jet turbines, people screaming, distant artillery, and you've got to hold your hover, get your people loaded, count heads, and get back out over a city where somebody might decide to shoot at you on the way up. The Marines on the ground were magnificent. They held the perimeters, controlled the loading, kept order when order wanted to dissolve. But the math was brutal. Each CH-53 could carry maybe 50 or 60 people if you packed them in. Each CH-46, maybe half that. And there were thousands of people inside those compounds, and tens of thousands more who'd been promised evacuation and couldn't get through the chaos to reach a pickup point. The runs went on all day, and then all night. Helicopter after helicopter, a cycle that just didn't stop. Pilots were flying until they could barely keep their eyes focused on the instruments. Some of those Marine crews flew 18 hours straight. You'd land on the carrier deck, they'd push the evacuees off the back ramp, you'd hot refuel, and you were headed right back in. No crew rest, no debrief, just go. And the embassy itself, that's where the images come from that everyone remembers. The rooftop. That famous photograph, the one most people think shows the embassy roof, actually shows a CIA safe house apartment building at 22 Gia Long Street. An Air America Huey is on top, people climbing a ladder to reach it. But the embassy rooftop evacuations were real, too. The Marine CH-46 pilots were landing on a pad that was never designed for sustained operations, on top of a building, at night, in a city, without reliable power, using car headlights and signal flares for lighting. Think about that for a second. You're a helicopter pilot making an approach to a rooftop pad in a blacked-out city with small arms fire popping off below you, and your landing lights are a couple of car high beams pointed upward by Marines who are hoping you can see them. Now here's a story within the story that every pilot needs to hear. As the evacuation went on, South Vietnamese Air Force pilots started taking matters into their own hands. They loaded their families into whatever they could fly. One Hueys mostly, but also Chinooks, observation helicopters, anything with a rotor, and they headed for the fleet. Dozens of them. They'd fly out over the South China Sea, find a carrier or an amphibious ship, and try to land. The ships weren't expecting most of them. The flight decks were already packed with American helicopters coming and going. So the crews started pushing helicopters overboard. Brand new Hueys shoved off the deck into the ocean to make room for the next one coming in. Millions of dollars worth of aircraft just pushed into the sea because the people mattered more than the machines. And then there's Major Buang Lai. He was a South Vietnamese Air Force pilot, and he didn't have a helicopter. What he had was a Cessna 01 Bird Dog, a two-seat single-engine observation plane. He loaded his wife and five children into that tiny airplane. Five kids and his wife in a two-seat Bird Dog. He took off from Khon Son Island and headed for the fleet. He found the USS Midway, and he flew low over the deck and dropped a handwritten note that said, "Can you move the helicopters to the other side? I can land on your runway. I can fly 1 hour more. Please rescue me." Captain Larry Chambers, the commanding officer of the Midway, and the first African-American to command an aircraft carrier, by the way, read that note. And he made the call. He ordered the crew to push helicopters overboard to clear the landing area. They shoved Hueys worth hundreds of thousands of dollars each over the side, and Buang Lai brought that little Bird Dog in. Touched down on the flight deck of an aircraft carrier, a fixed-wing tail dragger landing on a carrier deck without a hook, without a barricade, with his whole family crammed inside. He stopped with room to spare. That photograph, the Bird Dog parked on the Midway's deck, that's one of the most extraordinary images in aviation history. A father who refused to leave his family behind, flying an airplane that had no business being on a carrier deck, making it work because there was no other option. By the time the last helicopter lifted off the embassy roof, it was almost 8 in the morning on April 30th. That final bird was a CH-46 call sign Lady Ace, 09, carrying the last 11 Marines from the embassy security detachment. They'd held the roof all night. When they lifted off, they left behind hundreds of Vietnamese who'd been told they'd be evacuated. Ambassador Martin had to be directly ordered by President Ford to get on a helicopter. He didn't want to leave. In roughly 18 hours, Operation Frequent Wind evacuated more than 7,000 people. Over the preceding weeks, the fixed wing and helicopter operations combined had moved more than 50,000, but nobody was counting victories that day. There was no celebration on those carrier decks. Pilots shut down their engines, climbed out, and just sat on the deck. Some of them cried. The adrenaline was gone, and what was left was the weight of everyone they couldn't get to. The helicopters that had carried all those people to safety, most of them were pushed overboard afterward. The South Vietnamese aircraft, the Marine birds that were too damaged or too many to restow, they went over the side. The ocean floor off the coast of Vietnam is littered with Hueys and Sea Knights and Bird Dogs. Each one of them carried somebody's last flight out. I think about those pilots sometimes. Not the politics, not who was right or wrong about the war, just the aviators. The Marine crews who flew until their arms were shaking from the cyclic. The Air America pilots who'd been doing this kind of work in the shadows for years and never got a parade. Vuong Le and his Bird Dog. The South Vietnamese helicopter pilots who bet everything on one flight over open water with their families behind them. That's what aviators do when it matters. They fly. They find a way. April 29th, 1975, 51 years ago today. The day the helicopters were the only thing between chaos and survival. Most of what I shared today comes from the accounts in Last Men Out by Bob Drury and Tom Clavin, along with the Naval History and Heritage Command archives, and the first-hand Marine Corps oral histories from Frequent Wind. If you want to go deeper, those are worth your time. Fly safe out there. And the next time you pre-flight a helicopter and think about what those machines can really do, remember SaigonRadioHangar.com. I'm Tail Dragger. See you next time.